This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by TradeStation. Get 90 days free TradeStation, free data, and free commissions.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Horrible jobs numbers, but stocks rally. January indicator debunked. Blame the weather. Listener questions and our guest Dennis Gartman today. All this and much more on episode number 350 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hi, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here. Hopefully you are doing great watching some of the Olympics. Did you see that opening ceremony? They had the floor of the Olympic Stadium, the area where they did the opening of the latest 2014 Olympics in Sochi, Russia. And the floor had, I think it was like 60 different projectors from one side and another side, creating the view of the map of the countries as the Olympic participants walked in and were announced. And after that, the show they had created this 3D vision of things like a boat and the choreography of the people walking along and dancers walking along the boat, and it was a three-dimensional sea and wind, and wow, that was pretty cool. That was one of the best ones I've seen. I like China a few years ago, but this was outrageous. I thought it was really cool. Hopefully you'll have the opportunity to see that. If you haven't, there's sure to be replays of that on YouTube and all over the place. I would check it out. I think it was really, really well done. And Vladimir Putin was up there watching the whole thing. He was stoic. I think he smiled once. And it was very proud of the history that they presented of Russia through the opening ceremonies and through when they did the beyond the introduction of the Olympic participants. But they did the whole production of dance and song and the horses that were on wires and all sorts of cool things happening there. But the Olympics are here. I'm looking forward to many of the events. I am partial to curling, which is maybe strange to some of you. It's throwing a rock along a icy surface and people sweeping in front of it. It's strange, but it's a pretty cool game. It's like, I guess, what the older people do here down in Florida with shuffleboard they do on ice in the Olympics. It's fun. Hopefully you'll get to watch it. There's plenty of it on. And what I found also is sometimes during the day you see that it's on, let's say, NBC. Sometimes it's on another subchannel of NBC, but you can pretty much find an Olympics on throughout the day, which is kind of cool. One of the things that we're going to talk about today is the economics that we saw last week. There were some disappointing numbers in the manufacturing numbers that we saw last week or so, and we saw the markets really come down very hard into that, and the problem has been that the concern about the weather, the concern about what's going on in the emerging markets, maybe just a consumer that's been slowing down a bit. Clearly, we saw that in retail sales overall. But at the same time, we saw that the service sector of the ISM did pretty good. At least it held up pretty well. Generally speaking, economics, if you take a look at that and you look at just the trend of what's going on from the main and the core economics, we're seeing a bit of a slowdown. We're seeing that there has been something that has changed. Again, maybe it's the polar vortex that is being blamed and maybe the weather, but there's something that has taken a little bit of a turn. And I think that's something that's going to be watched very closely because at the same time, many of the Fed speakers that have been coming out have been reiterating that they are on a $10 billion per month of reduction in bond purchases. And that is going to be the standard default, as one of them said, unless something very severe happens. Now, I'm not sure how severe, if we have to see that there's going to be a deflationary environment or a real slowdown and contraction in manufacturing or the jobs numbers. We did see that this is the second month in a row that the jobs numbers did, in fact, disappoint. Only 113,000 new were added. expectations were for about 180,000. But the jobless rate went to 6.6%. And that's the thing that a lot of people look at, particularly if you're just looking at the headlines and maybe you're not in the U.S. You're looking at, okay, how is the job situation? Well, we see that it went to a 6.6%. And it did so with an increase in the labor participation. Very slight increase, but an increase nonetheless. So therefore, even though the last couple of months we didn't see that the numbers came in to be anywhere near expectations, there was a little bit better of a unemployment rate. Now, when the and this is, I thought was very interesting. When the number first was splashed out there at 8:30 in the morning on Friday, the initial reaction was a little bit muted for a little bit, and then all of a sudden you saw that the futures came in pretty hard. They came down really from, I guess it was about 10 points, from about a plus 8 to a negative 2 or 3, and then kept on going. And all of a sudden, about 10 minutes in, somebody woke up and said, hey, maybe this is a buying opportunity because you fill in the blank. Not exactly sure what it was that they found to be exciting about that. Maybe it was the rate. Maybe it was, I can't really tell you. There was nothing good in the jobs numbers that I found that would really lead me to believe that there was a substantial opportunity to really pounce the market up. Although, what did you notice? Just from a technical standpoint, the prior day on Thursday, there was a bit of a reversal and an up move in the markets. And that maybe was just a simple follow through where all of a sudden there was a desire that after about 4 or 5 weeks of down markets and stocks getting hit pretty badly, hey, you know what? We're going to start some buying here and see if it can move. And what you saw was a continuation. Now, it was on very tepid volume. The volume at the end of the day on Thursday and on Friday was not impressive. Now you say, well, Andrew, listen, over the last couple of years, anytime we saw volume on the upside, it really wasn't great. But, you know, when you see that markets are, in fact, dropping off and kind of coming in a bit, and the volume, particularly on those negative days, has been very much elevated, and then you see that there is limited volume on the upside. That's different than a market that's in an uptrend that is just adding on to it over time, and the volume here and there is lackluster. You really need to see the institutions taking a hold and buying in and really turning it, or the potential is that they're going to let it ride up for a little bit, get some benefit from the upside, and then sell into it pretty hard. So we'll see what happens from here, but the question really remains that what is different right now than we saw maybe 2 weeks ago that all of a sudden there is a desire to buy? It could be the earnings. You know, we did see about 75% of the companies that have reported have beat estimates and they're coming in better. Usually you see about a 68%. Only about half the companies that are going to report have reported already. But still, there's also the underlying discussion that, hey, you know what, this is really a kind of a 1 or 2 month event because we're seeing that the weather has been a big component of many of the drops and many of the rationale involved in what's going on with the economy. Now, the idea from that is that, hey, you know what, if the weather, in fact, is the culprit, it's not going to last forever. I mean, summer does come around, right? So I think that's a big part of what's going on. There's some rationalization going on that the weather is a short-term event. It's a variant that is, you know, much greater than we've seen in the past, and it's not going to last forever. Look at what happened with natural gas. Natural gas went through the ceiling on the weather, and then as soon as it kind of tapered off, hey, boom, it dropped. So there is that going on, and I think more so if you look at what is going on with just simply looking at the charts in terms of the index itself, there was an opportunity for that reversal. And a lot of times when you see a reversal and a move down during the day, and then sometime during the day, it starts moving higher and you see a, whether it's a candle or however you're looking at your particular chart, you're seeing that it ended on the high or close to the high. The follow through is usually there and you get a short squeeze. Again, depending on how long that short squeeze goes on, or if in fact it is a real return to an uptrend, will be seen. But with 4 weeks of selling going on and none of the underlying issues really taken care of, we still have a lot of problems in the emerging markets, a lot of outflows. Turkey was downgraded by S&P last week to a negative. you know, you have to start sort of think that, you know, right now it may be just one of those choppy environments and take some precautions. Now, that doesn't mean you want to, you know, throw everything away. There's some good places to be out there, of course, but you want to be being a little bit more cautious right now. And when you look at, again, the charts, and you can see that there really was a dramatic move, it could be really just simply thought of as a midterm contraplay in a bigger and a longer term move to the downside. Yet to be seen. I want to mention, by the way, that when you're looking at charts and you're looking at the conditions of the markets, obviously there's a lot of things you can look at. You look at the fundamentals, you look at the overall news that's happening, not only here, but overseas, and you kind of put it all together. But one of the best ways to look at this is through charts. And one of the things that I think you should be checking out is TradeStation, because that's what we use for charting, by the way. And we have actually a good amount of indicators that we write for TradeStation through trigger charts. But the thing about TradeStation that's really nice is there's many different components. They have their radar screen, which gives you a – this is really cool and it's unique. It's essentially a grid, like an Excel grid, but in each one of the cells, it's like a mini chart. So you get the result of maybe a moving average. You get the result of an indicator, and you can actually program it pretty easily. But you don't have to put up all these charts to scan, and you can have alerts right inside of this thing called a radar screen. And you also have a scanner, and you also have unlimited amount of charting and workspaces and things that you can put on. They give you a ton of free indicators. Their data is excellent, and you could actually trade as well right there. And you can use automated trading strategies. You can use just manual. But the nice thing is you get 90 days of free TradeStation by signing up and getting a particular, a starter package, if you will. You get the platform. Radar screen, you get the data and free commissions for 90 days. I mean, that's enough time to evaluate it to see if maybe this is something that can benefit you. And if you're using anything else, you know, pick your poison what you're using. I got to tell you something. Seriously, this is the program that we really like. And there's a lot of them we could use, but this is the one that we've done and used for years for charting. And they keep on getting better. The latest version with their apps and their app store is amazing. They have this trading app store where actually professionals and whether they're writing strategies, whether they're writing indicators, whether they're writing any kind of other program that will be able to give you more data are available through the trading app store. This is just really great. Go over to TradeStation.com. We have links on the website and get your 90 days free. Before we get to our guests, let's talk about a couple of things. I have some excellent questions that came in. You can always write me at AskAndrew@TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. And the first one is from Dan. He talks about how he loves the show and he has some questions regarding China. He talks about how we always hear about how much money we owe China. And it's obvious that there was an intention to create a trade advantage on China's side while investing in a more reliable economy in the world, but the impact of lower bond prices for China does not seem to get the proper publicity that it should. If rates dramatically rise for long-term bonds, it would have a devastating effect on China and the value of the bonds. And as you pointed out, they can either sell or take major losses or return to a certain substantially lower amount of investment that they have. So he goes on to ask then, what is the negative side of China's position that is really not discussed other than ours? And can you please discuss this topic more? And how much money is owed by China and where can you find it, etc.? Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, essentially you could find the amount of, if you go over to the Federal Reserve, and there's a variety of places to get the statistics on this. You could find exactly how much China is, how much bonds they own by date, by the amount of time that it's due, and in raw money. And this is pretty much, Dan, this is pretty much available all over the place. I don't think it's a secret, as far as we know. But you go to the Treasury, ustreasury.com. I think the Federal Reserve also has the same information, but the Treasury is definitely one place that would have it because they have the information about that. Obviously, you could just Google, how much is China's holdings of U.S. debt, and I think that would be a place you could find as well. Bloomberg also has this data, and we have access to that, and then maybe at the Bloomberg site as well. The thing that I'll mention to you is, and I think what you pointed to was, what if we do, in fact, raise our interest rates consistently over time, and how does that really affect China, and what happens there? You have to remember something. The whole deal is that China's not going to sell and really do an outright major amount of selling of U.S. bonds, because the way this whole thing is set up is to have mutual destruction in the event of any kind of misstep with bonds. So what happens is that it's set up in a way that, in the event that China releases and sells and doesn't buy, there's a problem with trade. You have to remember that China is very reliant on the U.S. for trade. So the whole bond game that goes on is really not something that I worry about necessarily, because it would really be very destructive to China as well if they did in fact go and sell our bonds. If the only thing you have to realize that if in fact rates come up, and if in fact their bond values go down, that also means that the dollar goes up, which also means that the dollar goes up comparatively and we can buy more products from them. So that's on one side negative, and on the other side it's a positive, and vice versa, obviously. The reality is that the U.S. is trying their best to deflate the value of their bonds, and they're trying to essentially get rid of the valuation by a constant dropping of the currency if they can. But of course, that goes against the whole idea of what happens if, in fact, we raise rates. There's a plenty of time, until rates go up in the U.S. I mean, historically, we've had a Fed that would utilize measures like the Fed funds rate to regulate the economy. Bringing it down a few percentage points would do amazing things for the economy, because loans would be cheaper, money more available, etc. Now we have bond purchases that are going to last, if nothing else, the rest of the year, at least. And then we have still, on top of that, a 0 to a 0.25% level of Fed funds. Just the fact that we have the 0 to 0.25% should in itself be stimulative. So I'm not really worried right now about the actual, the Chinese holdings of our securities, because I do think that they realize and we realize at the same time that doing anything severe would impact trade on both sides, and nobody wants that. Okay, the next question that came in was from, Saya. And Saya writes that, so what is the strategy when something blows up after hours? For example, like Green Mountain Coffee Roasters did the other day. Automatic stops don't usually activate after hours, right? Do you pull your stop since it would have activated right at the open the next day and probably make things worse? Or do you just let it happen and take the hit? Well, we know about this from personal experience. We had a short position in Green Mountain Coffee Roasters last week that hurt like a real bugger. It's kind of like a punch right to the kidney. And they announced that Coca-Cola was going to be taking a 10% stake in the company, and they're going to come out with something called the Keurig Cold, which is a device that will make soda. It will make Coca-Cola, cold drinks. And then the idea then swirled around that, wow, this is a great thing. Now, mind you, the earnings weren't great on Green Mountains, and standalone, excluding the Coca-Cola information, it really wasn't a great looking quarter, and the outlook was questionable, but there it was. This event that they had a new partner that had some serious amount of ability to really bring them some additional opportunity. Now they sold the shares to Coca-Cola at $74 per share, well below the current price before trading reopened. And when trading did reopen, it was up about 30-ish percent, and it kind of really flew up. So, yes, I agree with you that the automatic stops won't work. What do you do? On that kind of news, when you see that going against you, you have to be patient and look at what's going on with the actual position. Is it just a short squeeze that's going to come down? And we did see it move as high as, I think, 117 or something like that in the after hours. We cut it at about 110. But, you know, you have to be willing to take the hit. You have to be willing to realize that with that kind of situation, there's a lot of other people that are short as well, and they're going to try to pile in and buy into it and move the stock, because simply it's an onslaught of buying that goes on between the buyers and the shorts that are covering. So, you know, you take your licks and you move on unless there's something in there that you see that doesn't make sense. Now, in this circumstance, you know what? It's kind of time to throw in the towel on this right now on the short because there's too much of an opportunity that people are seeing in this, even though they have not come out with this product yet. But looking at who their partner is, you know, you have to say that they're going to try to push this forward. Now, on that, you also saw that SodaStream, S-O-D-A, came in. It was down about 14 or 15% on this news, thinking that, hey, you know what? This is going to be a real problem because you have some competition that was never there before. Well, immediately, the buzz was out and dropped pretty hard. And then all of a sudden, the next day, it started opening and started climbing higher because all of a sudden, there was speculation that maybe SodaStream is going to be a target of acquisition by Pepsi. Now, that's a little far-fetched for a variety of reasons. Possible, but far-fetched. And SodaStream was up from the level that it moved in the after hours down about 15%. I think it was up about, 10, 12% or so the next day. And that really is a bit absurd. Now, they have earnings coming out next week. I think it's on the 18th, I believe it is. But at the same time, you have to realize that their overall sales have been dropping. And while they may be looking to bring in a partner, it's a much different circumstance. It's a current device that's out there, and it's also, it doesn't look like Pepsi would really want to be involved with this, again, for a couple of different reasons. Possible, but, you know, highly unlikely. SodaStream looks like it, at this point, has really taken the hype to a pretty good extreme here, and we would not really be buyers of this. I mean, again, excluding the earnings that are coming out here, it looks like this is a little bit overdone, and it looks like they really will have significant amount of impact on SodaStream. Now, the bigger issue that you have to look at is now that you have this announcement by Green Mountain, and now that they have this machine that's going to be worked on and sometime in the future announced, the people that were going to be buying a SodaStream device may be saying, wait a minute, you know what? Let me see what this other device looks like. Let me see what they have to offer before I put some new money into buying a SodaStream product. Now, if that's the case, it's really going to hurt SodaStream's overall revenue stream for the next, 3 to 6 months, easy. So think about that and think about the move here. So you had a speculative move on, maybe Pepsi will buy it or not. And then think about what's really going to happen with SodaStream's revenue stream moving forward. So I think the answer to your question is simply, you know, sometimes you just have to take your pain and deal with it and live with it. And these things do happen with stocks that are unforeseeable. But it is what it is. On the long side and the short side, you have to be willing to cut a position. Or even if you feel very strongly about it, add to that position in the direction that you were previously going. Or sometimes flip it all the way around and realize that, hey, you were wrong. Simple. If you want your question answered, just simply write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And we'll do our best to get it on the air. We're going to get to our guest. I want to mention, after we talk with Dennis Gartman, I'm going to want to talk to you a little bit about some of the economics that are coming up this week, and I want to talk to you about a couple of stocks that I have some ideas about. All right, Dennis Gartman is with us today, as I mentioned earlier, and this is a great time to have him on. He's a great guy that really studies the markets, particularly commodities, and the functions of how futures are working. He is the founder and editor of the Gartman Letter, and we'll tell you in a little while how you can get your free trial of that. Dennis, how are you? Happy New Year.
I'm old and tired, but as we said earlier, nobody's thrown anything at me. Nobody shot at me. My wife's still with me, and my daughters still love me, so all is right.
Wow, you got it going, man.
I got it going.
So how's your foot?
I'm okay. I haven't stepped on any landmines or anything.
But you know what? You are, I think if you haven't, I'm going to say that you have coined the idea that, you know, I light things that if they fall on my foot, it will hurt.
It's a good mnemonic device. I wanted to own simple things, basic things, ships and steel and maybe a few commodities along the way, trains, those sorts of things. Very simple things. I'm too old and too set in my ways to understand high tech, so I wanted to buy the simple things that are incumbent in domestic and in global economic growth, because I think that's really where we are. And the mnemonic device was, I want to buy the things that if I drop them on my foot will hurt. And it made sense to people.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. That's, you know, and a lot of times, though, a lot of people thinking about commodities. I know you're very, you know, involved with commodities, and there's been a lot of action in that particular area. And I was kind of curious what, with what, you know, we've been hearing about the, you know, the death of gold, for example, and, you know, the concern about that, hey, we're going to see the Fed stepping back from their bond buying, and that is the eventual course towards tightening, that, you know, we're going to see gold just plummet. You know, you got Harry Dent that thinks, I think, gold is just going away, actually. And you have the Goldman, who is all about, like, you know, really low numbers on that. What's your opinion on the precious metals?
Well, I think the time for being negative of gold, for being short of gold, is past. I'm not sure the time to be a demonstrative buyer is upon us, but I think the time for being short is past. I do like gold in non-U.S. dollar terms. Mm-hmm. I like gold in terms of yen because the monetary authorities in Japan have no choice but to do what they have been doing for the past year and a half and will continue to do for the next several years, which is to expand the supply of reserves, yen, in their system at a demonstrably faster rate than even our Fed is expanding reserves here. So if I'm going to own gold, I want to own gold in terms of yen. I know that sounds difficult, but it's really quite easy to accomplish. It's going to be easier in about a week and a half when there's a new ETF that comes out to do precisely that.
Mm.
But until then, one can buy GLD and one can sell the IMM futures short of the Japanese yen, and that creates gold in yen terms.
Right.
So I'm really quite I'm bullish of gold in yen terms. I'm getting that way in terms of euro. I am not bullish of gold yet in terms of the dollar. I may get that way eventually, but I am not yet.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think we need to find out what the word in Japanese is for kitchen sink, because that would be probably the best way to describe their policy right now. And
oh, very good.
You know,
yeah, they have to throw the entire kitchen sink at their problem. They have been in a deflationary environment for literally 25 years. The only way that they're going to come out is to devalue the yen. I actually think today is an important day as far as the yen dollar rate is concerned, because you had a weakness in the Japanese yen early this morning. Now you have, or I should say, weakness in the dollar, strength in the yen this morning. Now you're turning that around rather dramatically. And if you're a technician, you're getting a reversal day here in the dollar yen, which I think today may prove to be, from some point in the future, we'll look back and say there was a turning point again back to a much weaker yen.
Hmm.
I think people running to the yen in the past week and a half as a safe haven is one of the truly illogical moves of our time.
I didn't understand that either. I get that. That, and by the way, I really never understood it, just as a point of reference. Right? I mean, they have the biggest debt outstanding, and while I understand that there was a major amount of appeal because of all the exports they had, right? That was the underlying reason why people would go to the yen, because of the safe haven status. In other words, it was like a revenue bond. You know, we knew they had this deal. We knew they had the revenue. So, you know, what the heck? But now that they are, you know, even though they can't, quote unquote, supposedly say it, we know that they're trying to weaken the yen to a level that's ridiculous. Right. We know that they're going to do whatever it takes. They have no choice. Either they're going to do this or they're not going to do this. And if it busts them by doing it, not doing it, we know would have busted them.
Well, we know that it's going to do it. And let's also consider the fact that the Japanese are pursuing one of the silliest energy programs in the world today. They have stopped, and I understand the problem of Fukushima from 2 years ago, and I understand the disconcertion that causes, but to walk away from 35% of your electricity power generation and to try to go to green power generation, or to have to import high-priced natural gas to fire electricity generation, makes no sense at all. But you actually have governors running on anti-nuclear power programs. It is politically correct to do it. It is economically ludicrous that they are continuing to do it. It makes no sense to me at all.
I think we have to point out that it wasn't that it was the problem of the nuclear power that caused the problems in Fukushima. It was the idiocy of building it so close to the water in an area that is prone to getting all sorts of potential tsunamis, and not doing what they should have done if they had to do that by building up the walls high enough. That was encouraged by many experts.
Yeah, I mean, that was the primary problem that Japan created for itself. You could have put those nuclear power plants anyplace else, but to put them there made no sense. And then to close down everyone else makes even less sense. But nonetheless, that's what they're doing, and I think their only way out is to devalue their currency. Right now we're talking 102 yen to the dollar. I think over the course of the next 2 years, you have to go back to 200 yen to the dollar to give them a chance.
Wow.
Now, I know that sounds bizarre, but you have to remember, when I began trading foreign exchange in the early 1970s, I can remember trading spot foreign exchange at 275 yen to the dollar, and it had been trading 365 yen to the dollar 2 years prior to that. So for me to think that dollar yen can get back 150 or 200, that's not that great a leap of faith. And for somebody who's only been trading foreign exchange for a year or two, that sounds ludicrous. To me, it sounds eminently doable, to be honest.
Yeah. Now, in terms of natural gas and oil, obviously natural gas recently saw a continuation of the spike due to these, and whenever I say this, I usually try to put an echo on it, but the polar vortex and all the things that are going on with the weather. But one of the things we've noticed is there is a change to the structure of the outward futures contract, where we had, for the most part, some contango for a while. Now we have backwardation in both the natural gas and in the oil futures.
Right.
What is that telling you, and how can we take advantage of that?
Backwardation is always the hallmark of a bull market. Backwardation, when markets go to backwardation, when spot rates are above the first contract, when the first contract is above the second is higher than the third higher than the fourth, when you have a market that goes into backwardation, what it's telling you is demand, and it's a demand-driven circumstance, that demand is stronger than its supply, and you don't. The first rule of that I learned 35 years ago in trading is you don't sell backwardated markets. You may not buy them, but you truly do not sell them short. And we have a backwardation now in crude oil, both in WTI and in Brent. And in nat gas, you went to preposterous, egregious, comical, silly, violent backwardations. That one predicated upon the weather, with the dichotomy in the weather here in the States, with this vortex coming down and bringing the coldest weather in probably the past 50 years to the eastern seaboard. And at the same time, you have drought and hot weather on the west coast, on the left coast. So it's a bizarre weather circumstance that has driven the nat gas backwardation. Be careful with natty. There's a lot of people, there are a lot of producers whose banks are looking at deferred futures contracts trading above $4. And as a fracker looking for nat gas, $4 natty is a very hedgeable circumstance, and a lot of the banks are forcing them to be selling out the back contracts. But in the front months in natty, because of the very cold weather, I mean, you had the nat gas on the board trading at 550, but in some areas around the country, you had, and this is hard to believe, you had nat gas trading on the spot market at 150. If you needed nat gas, if you were a farmer and you needed some, if you were an employer and you needed some, you had to pay up whatever it was for 3 days worth of supply. That just showed you how tight the supply was. The oldest rule in the book, you just don't sell a backwardated market until you start to see the backwardations begin to narrow, and they're not doing that.
Right, especially for long term. I mean, it's one thing doing it maybe throughout the day here and there to clip something, but clearly not for
a 2 week or 3 week period of time. You just don't do that.
Exactly. Now, in terms of the rest of the environment, when it comes to, you said you like trains. Well, we saw that KSU really was derailed. How do you like that? There you go. was derailed. And there was some concern about that, and that maybe there's something happening. But is the transportation? So we'll cover, I guess, two things. First would be what we call U.S.-based trains, and then globally the shipping lines. Are they still pretty hot in terms of their cargo, or how do you see things?
Cargo's large. The problem that the shipping industry has, the amount of cargo being moved is really quite extraordinary. It's large. It's large and getting larger globally, domestically, and cargo is moving around the world. Trade is being done. The problem that you have in the shipping business, but yet the shipping stocks are acting reasonably well, is that there's new supply coming at you, and the supply of new ships, these are monster ships that we're building out there. They're very efficient. To put this in the proper context, 10 years ago, a ship that carried 8,000 TEUs, 20-foot export units as they're called, a ship that carried 8,000 to 10,000 TEUs was a big ship. Then we were starting to do 10,000 and 15,000 TEU ships, big ships. Now we got ships out there carrying 18,000 to 20,000 trailers, TEUs upon them, 20,000 trailers upon these things. The efficiency of, once you start a ship moving, the cost of driving that ship, whether it's 1,000 TEUs or 20,000 TEUs, is relatively, it's almost inconsequentially small. Mm-hmm. Getting them loaded, getting them moving, overcoming inertia is one thing, but moving them long distance, that once that ship's inertia is overcome, it's pretty cheap to ship a big, to move a big ship. And that's what we're doing. We're running enormous. We're taking down 5 and 6 small 3,000 TEU ships, and we're putting up 2 or 3 20,000 TEU ships. So we're taking the numbers of ships out of the market, but we're increasing the amount of TEUs they're carrying. Even that having occurred, the shipping stocks seem to be taking it in stride very well. If you're going to look at shipping stocks, look at SEA, look at the shipping ETF. That's probably the easiest and best place to gain exposure, and the liquidity is extraordinary.
Yeah, that's a big thing. You know, we saw recently with ETFs, actually, it was interesting that, I believe it was last week or the week before, there is a particular ETF that does Turkish lira that had about $500 million in it. And I think in a matter of a couple of days, they ripped out like $450 million of that ETF. And this is something interesting, I think, with ETFs, is that you have to look beyond just the name, look at the holdings, how long have they been there, and, you know, I think not all ETFs are created equal, right?
Would you agree? Not all ETFs are created equal. I mean, the GLD, for example, I don't know, what has it got, $7 billion in it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably going to stay, no matter what happens, probably going to stay above. It probably will never fall down by half from what it was 2 years ago, even through this bear market. But a Turkish lira ETF, are you kidding me?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry. You can trade it. I think I shan't.
No, I'm not getting near that. But let me ask something about the gold. You know, one of the things that happened with the gold ETF very quickly is that I had thought that because the amount of backing of gold they had the physical in storage, that if, in fact, we ever saw a substantial amount of decline in gold, that would put more gold physical on the market because they have to get rid of it, which could create additional downward pressure. And I've talked to a few people about this, and they say, well, that doesn't make any sense. And I can't figure out how it doesn't make sense. Any thoughts?
Quite honestly, a wise man said, when you don't know something, tell them you don't know. I've never thought about it in those terms, and so if whatever I would say right now would be, as they would say, could and should be used against me in a court of law. So I'll simply stand down.
Okay, last thing. You know, last year, I think sometime in the beginning part of the year, you went pretty much to the bullish side of equities.
Yes.
I'm not going to nail the exact date that you did it, but you went bullish on equities.
I was.
You really didn't let up. Where are you now?
Beginning 2 weeks ago, and I was very succinct about this, beginning 2 weeks ago, I said I've been bullish of stocks for the last 6 or 7 months. I've been relentless in it. And for the first time, I'm actually getting a little sanguine about stocks. Sell calls against everything that you have, which was the first move to the sidelines. And then about 3 days later, I said, not only do I want to sell calls against everything, I think it's time to start buying some derivatives to protect on the downside. And then last week, I said, not only do I want to protect on the downside, I want to get as neutral as I possibly can. So if you haven't sold calls, or if you have sold some, make sure that you bought enough derivatives to protect yourself on the downside. Buy SDS or sell short the triple Qs or sell short S&P futures sufficient to get to market neutrality. As I've said, it's still a bull market in stocks. And in a bull market, you can only have one of three positions: really long, nicely long, or neutral. This mm-hmm. is still a bull market. And it's probably going to continue to be a bull market. But for a while, I think that from the top, we could be down 8 to 12% with no difficulty. And I don't know about you, but 8 to 12% is a long way down. I think one should take some protection. So I am dead solid neutral on stocks right now. I own some aluminum companies. I own some shipping companies. I own a little bit of Apple. I own a few banks. In my own pension funds, but I am dead neutral because I bought SDS and I bought OFF, which is an ETF to take for risk off. You buy it and you've now reduced the amount of risk that you have. I've gone to as close to market neutrality as I can.
Good. Well, Dennis Garman, actually, he does, I think, co-manage the off. And what's the other one? Is it on and off?
Yeah, on and off. On is risk on. Off is risk off. They are the absolute mirror of one another. And I've got a fair chunk of off in my retirement account. That's off and SDS are the two things that I've been using to hedge my retirement account, and they're very efficient.
Right. It's so great that you have such an easy thing to remember on and off, whereas...
Even I had to do it that way so that I could remember it.
Dennis Gartman, I know you have a trial of your newsletter, which is fantastic, by the way, folks. This man does... Maybe he sleeps, I don't know. But he puts this out at like 4 or 5 in the morning or starts writing it about then and puts it out for the next day fresh about commodities, about markets. Where can they get a trial?
The trial, very simple. Go to thegartmanletter.com on the web. There's a... It's very simple to log in. We'll be happy to send you a trial for, I think it's 3 weeks. It's free. Take a look at it. If you like it, you'll sign up. If you don't, you'll simply drift off into the ether. We don't keep cookies. We don't. We won't come back and haunt you. If you like it, you'll use it. Most of the large most of the large hedge funds, honestly, and almost every one of the major, the top 100 banks in the country, and most, if not all, of the top 15 energy companies are all subscribers. Grain traders subscribe. I like to say I'm the liberal arts major of the capital markets. I take a view of a little bit of everything. And I get up at 1 o'clock every morning. I have this out to everybody by 5 a.m. I've been doing it now for 26 years, and something I'm proud of, I haven't missed a day in 26 years.
Wow. Wow.
Every business day. I have not been able to convince the British to take July 4 off. I haven't been able to convince anybody else to take off Labor Day or Memorial Day. So I have to write those days, and I've done it for 26 years.
I don't believe it. I mean, the only other record that I know that's like that is a Chinese restaurant.
Well, that and the Cleveland Browns never making it to the Super Bowl. One of the two.
Well, thanks, Dennis Gartman, for all that information. He's just a treasure trove of information, particularly on commodities and on markets. He is a gentleman who really studies this and knows it really well. And we'll take both sides of the equation and put it out there for you to do what you want with, but with a good amount of information that comes along with it so you can do your research. I mentioned in the beginning that we're going to talk about the January indicator. Now, I just talked about this on the DH Unplugged show last week, but I wanted to bring this to you. And what this is the idea that as goes January, so goes the year. You've heard that many, many times, and we did see that the January was a pretty ugly month in terms of returns for markets in the U.S. So the big question is then, what does that mean? Is that going to follow through into the rest of the year? Are we going to see this kind of situation that is going to continue? And does there have is there any real correlation between what happens in January and what happens during the year? So what we did was we went back to 1928 and we looked at all the occurrences of Januaries and how many of those times were positive, negative, and then looked at the returns for the year for each. So in total, it was 86 times that the January was recorded. Obviously, every year has January. No realization there. But there was only a 64 times or 74% of the time that actually January did in fact determine what the year would be in total. Now, there was 55 times that there were a total of positive Januaries, and of those 46 times, or 83%, there was an up year in total. Now, there was 31 times that there was a January that was negative, and 18 of those times, the year was negative, only 58% of the time. Now, when January was greater than 3% to the upside, you had a 75% chance of having a year that was positive. So the greater the January, the more return there was in January, the more potential there was for a year that was positive. Januaries that were greater than a 3% loss, there was a 63% chance of the time that you saw that the year itself would be lower. So in either case, the real ticket there was how much up or how much down was January, and that was a better indication, it seemed, more reliable to look at what would happen the rest of the year. So we used 3% because we found that that was the more reliable indicator. That was the demarcation point. That was the line in the sand that showed where the returns were the highest probability on both the up and the downside. Now, where are we now? I guess this year we're in, the January that had more than a 3% loss. And so we're in the 63% category, it seems, right now. I don't think it really tells us a lot I don't think there's a 100%, you know, you could go by this. I don't think that we have a situation where we could just blindly follow this, because there are about 40-35% of the time that in January, when it was more than a 3% loss, that there was actually a positive year. So I think that, just to debunk this for a second, I just don't really see that this is a usable indicator. It's interesting. You put it in the equation, but it's not something that I would bet money on. Let's put it that way. In terms of economics, what do we have coming up this week? Well, it's not a really busy week. It's the first week after the big number that we see, and usually we don't see a lot during that time, but we do see wholesale inventories that are going to be coming out on the 11th. We have retail sales. Now, retail sales will be important. This is the advanced retail sales on a month-over-month basis, and that's going to be on the 13th. We're going to see that the January period we're looking at, and last month we saw there was about ex-auto and gas, about a plus 0.7% on that, and we're looking at about 0.1%. So the expectation is that retail sales have been diminishing, and that goes along with everything that we've been seeing in terms of what is being said by many of the retail establishments out there. There's a few of them that have done very well, a few of them that have had some really good comparative same-store sales numbers, but generally speaking, there has been a slowdown in that. And if you want to blame that on the polar vortex, the cold weather, that's possible. Question is whether or not that if consumers are going to actually pick it up and do their job to make up the difference in the coming months. That's going to be a big issue. Initial jobless claims also on Thursday the 13th. So we're looking at about 330,000, which is where we've been for some time. We're continuing claims look to increase slightly as well. Then we have import prices. This is interesting because we are seeing that in the last set of numbers for GDP, we saw that the prices paid had been moving up very dramatically. When prices paid and the import numbers move higher, if they move higher, that means that manufacturers are paying more for the goods that they're going to manufacture. That being the case, then they're going to have to pass that on somehow, or you're going to see a reduction and a squeeze of margins. Usually what they do is they pass it on, unless they see it as a temporary situation. So we're going to see import prices. We're also going to see industrial production, capacity utilization on the 14th. And we're going to see the preliminary number of the Michigan confidence number on Friday. They're looking for about 80.5. Prior was 81.2, dropping down pretty significantly from where it was in prior months. So confidence has been coming down, and that correlates pretty well with what's happening with the consumer with retail sales. Other than that, I mean, really nothing major that I see here that's going to be blowout for markets. We have a lot of earnings still coming up in the next couple of weeks. I think that that is going to be a much better predictor, and I do also think that the continuation of the emerging market issue is going to be something that you want to look at. Now, there's been a lot of stocks that have taken a hit due to the emerging markets. You look at many of, for example, the companies that you wouldn't think would take as much of a hit in many market conditions because, for example, they're like a Procter & Gamble or a consumer staple. You know, a company that, you know, makes soap and dishwashing detergent and a whole host of things that are necessary and regularly used by individuals. Now, the problem is that these companies have become global. And as such, if the dollar is coming up and the emerging markets value of the currency of any particular country is coming down, it makes it much more expensive to buy the products of a company that does have a U.S. base. So if you look at the chart on Procter & Gamble, it's pretty surprising how much that has come in recently. And these are the companies that also, if things get a little bit calmer, maybe somehow become more normalized and there's not as much of an issue and the outflows are not as great, or the governments come in and do something, or the dollar moves down as it did on Friday, for example, on that pretty lousy number from the jobs number, which, by the way, is probably the main reason why we did see that rally, because if the dollar does come down finally, emerging markets numbers come up, it's better for many of the stocks that are export-driven, and the fact of the matter is it makes it at least look like there's some strength in the emerging markets. That being the case, the programs that were set to do a sell on the emerging markets as they compare the dollar of that or the currency of that market compared to the other market are going to go into sell mode, buy mode for that market, and sell mode for the U.S. dollar. So I want you to look at Procter & Gamble and Starbucks. Starbucks is a company that has been dropping for some time now, but one of the big reasons is that their global footprint has been a problem because the cost of their export, their cost of their product is much, much higher as those currencies come down in other countries. And we did see that the aileron indicator that we have for TradeStation did show a bottoming out last week and a signal for a turn in Starbucks, and you did get that very nicely on Thursday and Friday of last week, a nice pop, as a matter of fact, right off the bottom. And you did see that a few other indicators came in on the chart that looked much better, because right now there's really nothing significant about the Starbucks earnings story that we saw other than the fact that the global problem with many markets and the currencies affects them. So I want you to look at many of the companies in the consumer staple and maybe the global consumer discretionary as something that could benefit if there's a big if here, if the emerging market situation calms down a bit. Because what you'll see is that if, in fact, our currency continues to drop and their currencies come up, that will be very, very beneficial in a big way for these companies. So put those on your radar. And like I said, Procter & Gamble, I mentioned SodaStream earlier as a problem area, and Starbucks as on the plus side, okay? With that, we're going to end today, and we are booked solid for great guests over the next, I think, 6 or 7 shows coming up. So make sure to tune in to this. Of course, DH Unplugged, which we release on Wednesdays, myself and John C. Dvorak, talking about all sorts of crazy things. It's a little bit more of a free-for-all in that program, and we have a lot of laughs, a lot of fun, do some stock picking as well, and I think you really enjoy it. And make sure that if you are looking for a strategy, we have a variety of different ones. The latest one is our Arrow strategy, which is a strategy that really focuses on the S&P 500, long, short, out, in. Has a back test of, I think, about 2,400% since 1995. You can get your information over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just go to where it says Aero, A-I-R-O, and you can easily find all the information you need and a full and complete review of the strategy and all the data going back to 1995 and results and all that good stuff and everything you need to know. With that, thanks so much for joining me. I hope you watch the Olympics, particularly the curling. I think you'll get a kick out of that, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.